Thanks for clicking play on the Eastlake Tri-Cities Talks podcast. If you're new to this, we're trying to be the best church option for people in the Tri-Cities who aren't typically into church. We hope today's talk inspires you to take next steps in doing life in the way Jesus modeled and taught. If you're ever interested in being a part of one of our in-person gatherings, they take place every Sunday at the Uptown Theater in Richland. Check the website for current times. And regardless of what you look like, who you voted for, or where your tattoos are, we'd love to have you. But for now, here's our most recent talk. Well, good morning. Welcome to Eastlake. We're so glad that you are here. Congrats on making it out on Time Change Sunday, the bad one. I know it's second service, but that's still a good effort for you. You know what I mean? It's like you're attending the early one. But for those of you watching online on a replay, because it was Time Change Sunday, good to see you as well. Thanks for being here. Thanks for watching online, making that thing happen. Today, we are kicking off a brand new series called Via Dolorosa. It's a series on the way of the cross. That's what we're doing. It's going to lead up to Easter. And I wanted to start off with a quick question to kind of set the tone for why we're talking about this. When was the last time you had something on the calendar so important that you made lifestyle decision changes several weeks in advance? Something was coming up and you're like, I got to eat better. I got to sleep better. I got to do something. When was the last time something was on the calendar? You're like, that makes me kind of rethink what I'm doing. And about a week or so, for the past 16 years, a group of friends and I go down to Vegas to watch the March Madness games on the big screens. It's just a ton of fun, and we have a great time. A couple of them live everywhere else, and so this is our time once a year to get together and catch up on life. And this is about the time of year where I start adjusting my sleep schedule to kind of catch up and be ready to go, right? Because there's like nothing worse than being in Vegas and being tired, except being in Vegas and being broke. Those are the two things that you would say you don't want to do. But one of them is definitely you don't want to be tired. And so this is about the time of year, like 8:30 rolls around. I'm like, well, headed to bed. And my wife would be like, oh, that's so early. I'm like, well, you know, Vegas is only 9 days away. She's not happy for me. She doesn't support me in that. It's a thing. But I do remember too, one of the things that when I wrote this, I was like, I vividly remember we got married on June 10th of 2005. And so we're coming up on 20 years here pretty soon, which is exciting. 19 first, but then we get to 20 eventually. But anyways, and I remember getting fitted for my tux early, like maybe a month in advance. And then the realization hitting me, like I need to be about this size in a month, right? So you have to like adjust some things. And I remember talking about how like, oh man, that's gonna be different. That's gonna be something that I gotta really think about that. I can go one direction would be fine, but not the other direction, if that makes sense. And my wife goes, I feel real bad for you. I got my dress 6 months ago. You know what I mean? So I see you and I raise you a lot. So anyways, that's a tough thing that you, perhaps you had something similar. There was a vacation thing coming up. And so in order to be kind of financially flushed on vacation, to do vacation that you want the way that you wanted to do, you had to kind of tighten the belt early on the spending beforehand, leading up to it. Again, sleep schedule, kids schedule, something like that. You adjust some things to be able to make that future experience all the better. I bring all that up because we are 3 weeks out from Easter Sunday. And as your pastor, if Eastlake's home for you and you consider me that, I want to do my part to make you feel prepared for Easter. And by prepared, I do not mean I want to make sure you got enough candy in the you know, all the stuff and golden eggs. I don't care about that very much, a little bit, but not that much. What I mean is I want you to have a healthy understanding of the gravitas that is involved in the cross of Christ and the crucifixion of Jesus. And I for the next couple of weeks leading up to Easter, I want to kind of spend some time talking about this. And it is less practical than perhaps, you know, if you've been a part of Eastlake for any length of time, sometimes we'll do a series on, you know, money or family or being gracious or whatever, the one that we just got out of. This one is going to lean more theological. It's kind of probably lean more towards what you probably come to expect from a church in the weeks up to Easter and Palm Sunday and all that stuff. So that's just what we're fitting into. But I want to make you feel it and hopefully experience Easter a little bit better. So in order to do that, I'm going to read a familiar story that we'll obviously read more of in the weeks ahead. One that if you grew up in church around this time of year, you've probably read this as well. It shows up, this version, in Matthew chapter 27. It's interesting because all four of the Gospels, the Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the first four books of the New Testament, all have kind of a timeline of who Jesus was, what he did, and where he went, and who he healed, and who he talked to, and what all the things, right? And then all of them kind of speed through, they're like at a certain pace for like 20 chapters. And then right at the end, they all slow down as if the climax of the story of each of them is the final week of Jesus, Holy Week, leading up to Good Friday, leading up to his crucifixion, resurrection, and then it kind of picks up the pace after that. And so the details get more intricate. The way that the story is told, it's almost like if you've ever been around in a classroom or whatever, and the teacher goes, "All right, everybody lean forward. What I have to say now is most important." That's what we're reading today. If Matthew was here, he would say, all that other stuff is important, but this is what was most important. Here's what I remember about that time and that day. Matthew chapter 27, we're gonna start with verse 27 and go through 36. Here's what it says. Then the governor's soldiers took Jesus into the praetorium, that would be Pilate's residence or the governor's residence, and gathered the whole company of soldiers around him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him, and then they twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on his head. They put a staff on his right hand and knelt in front of him and said, and mocked him. They said, "Hail, King of the Jews." They spit on him and took the staff. They struck him on the head again and again. After they had mocked him, they took off the robe and put his clothes on him. Then they led him away to crucify him. And as they were going out, they met a man from Cyrene named Simon, and they forced him to carry the cross. They came to a place called Golgotha, and Matthew is trying to let his readership know that means the place of the skull. And there they offered him wine to drink mixed with gall, but he, after tasting it, he refused to drink it. It was like a numbing agent. It was kind of a gracious gift in that way. And he says, "I want to feel the full capacity of this." When they'd crucified him, they divided up his clothes by casting lots. And sitting down, they kept watch over him there. And above his head, they placed the written charge against him. "This is Jesus, King of the Jews." And again, it's a title is had a mockery sort of tone to it. It wasn't meant to be read with a straight face. It was meant to be read of wink, wink. This is what the King of the Jews looks like. Here's the future of them as a people. I mean, it's a passage that, it brings all kinds of emotions. You've probably watched movies that highlight this, Passion of the Christ or others. You've read books on this, paintings. I mean, in terms of material and content of where this kind of story is played out, there are more things written and talked about the crucifixion of Jesus than when he multiplied bread and fish, you know what I mean? Like this is such a common thing. And even if you are not really a church person, you have a general understanding. The average American, I think, has an understanding that Christianity has centered around Jesus's death on a cross means something. And it's not like one of those things. The church early on, even in Paul's writing, makes it clear that there are some things that maybe you can take or choose to leave when it comes to what happened really with Jesus, but this would not be one of them. This would be kind of part and parcel with the whole deal. This was critical. This was a component that deserves our attention, deserves our focus, deserves some of the things that have been written about it. And it would be fair to say, in light of that, though, that there has definitely been an evolution of meaning about what does it mean that Jesus died on a cross for us. I mean, even in the room today, if I was to hand out a little index card and say, what do you think it means that Jesus' death means for you? I mean, we have various opinions. If we did this with pastors of churches in the Tri-Cities, there'd be so it's not just like an education thing. Once you reach a certain level of education or whatever, then you know what the answer is. There are all kinds of different angles and perspectives to be able to take on this. And what it has meant has evolved over the years to kind of fit the thing. And oftentimes, distance creates clarity from something, right? Things get a little bit more clarified in this. We know this because we know a lot more about what happened at 9/11 now than we did on October 11th, 2001, right? The further apart from that, we kind of gather information and we have more information to go with. And so there's no doubt that the material about this is kind of been defined, and there are certain categories in which you could go, okay, substitutionary atonement, ransom atonement, all kind of different sort of theories of atonement, and what does Jesus' death mean to us? And practically speaking, you know this because in your life, you do the same thing. Distance away from something creates clarity about how to think about that. You had a relationship perhaps fall apart, and you call somebody up a week later, you're telling them the story, and they go, "What happened?" You're like, "I don't know. I mean, I said this, or I did this, or she went here. I'm still kind of making sense of the pieces." And then 2 years later, you're able to kind of fill in the gaps a little bit. That was going on. I had no idea that was going on at the moment, but there were some things behind the scenes. There was some stuff at work. There was all kinds of, and the further you are away from the event, the more clarity you have involved in that. And that's true about this as well. We are now centuries removed, millennia removed from Jesus's death on a cross. And so the amount of content out there to be like, well, you could go and think about it in this way, or you could think about it in this way. Which one's right? I mean, there's a lot of options out there. But in that moment, I wanna go back to that time. I wanna go back into that early scene where Jesus has just died, and what we are recorded on in the book, in the Gospels at the very after that, and then in the early part of the book of Acts, as they try and make sense of what does Jesus's death mean to me, the question that they were asking oftentimes was not what does it mean? What does Jesus' death mean? But what does it mean to die in the way that he did? Look at these. Remember the road to Emmaus? Jesus in John's Gospel is walking along the road after his resurrection. He comes up on two people who are talking amongst themselves, and he says, hey, what's going on, guys? What's the good word? And they say, have you not heard? Do you not know anything about the whole Jesus scene? Why are you guys angry? Why are you guys talking? Why are you so energetic about something? Well, we kind of like built our whole life around following this Jesus character. He was doing some great things. We thought he was the Messiah. We thought he was this. We thought he was the answer to everything that we've been hoping for years. And then he was crucified, and we just don't know what to do with that. And there are some people who are talking about a resurrection, but we don't even know. They right there, it shows that it was not clear what Jesus's death meant to them immediately after the fact. That would not come for a long time. Today, we ask, why did he have to die? That feels like the most pertinent question. Even amongst the skeptic, you're like, I'm into the Jesus thing. Okay, it's fine. I come to East Lake. I want to learn about what it means to live in the way of Christ. Some of that's very practical. I want to be a good person in humanity. I think Jesus seemed to be a really good human, and I want to take kind of aspects of that and perhaps build my life around that or do whatever. But then this whole idea of his death, and oh man, it's so good. And we celebrate it and we do communion. And you're like, why does it matter? Why do I need to take communion to remember that Christ died for me? Our question, our biggest, most pressing question is, why did he have to die? And their biggest, most pressing question at that moment was, why did he have to die in that way? And I think that those are two different things. And I think it's important for our time together to understand why that was so important for them in those moments. The mode in which he died is what was so insurmountable for them. To watch him do the things that he did and to die in the way that he died. The death of Jesus on a Roman cross was an event that lacked within itself a self-evident, or I put in the parentheses brackets, obvious, unambiguous interpretation. The two disciples on that road to Emmaus, their behavior and their words together communicates the presumed incongruity or the mismatch between the nature of his ministry and the manner of his end. The biggest deal for them, how do we deal with the nature of his ministry and the manner of his end? Not why did he have to die? Why did he have to die in that way? In the early decades of the Christian movement, the scandal of the cross was far more self-evident than was its meaning. That to die on a cross was a scandalous affair. All of them grew up with a verse and a law book, the Deuteronomy, Moses' last sermon to the Israelites before going into the promised land. And here's what we always have to remember and pass this along to your kids and post it on the walls of your homes and write it on their foreheads and whatever. Cursed be everyone that hangs on a tree. For somebody to be cursed, to hang on a tree, to be crucified, that's only reserved for the worst of the worst. Anyone who condemned by the law as a blasphemer suffers such a death is accursed and excluded from the circle of the living and from the fellowship of God. Meaning that there was a style of death reserved for people who did not even belong to be included in the circle of the living and not known by God. Their existence to be completely forgotten. And to have someone as great as Jesus doing the ministry that he did in the way that he did it, to then die that kind of a death, how could a God allow something like that there's far better ways to experience being a martyr. For them, this was no way about it. To live and to die and to be immediately forgotten as if we never existed. This style of death was a way of Rome communicating to anybody who would see, this is the death of a nobody. Follow at your own risk. What he stood for, what she stood for, what they said, what they valued, their way of life, they're a nobody. Follow at your own risk. For the world to see somebody like Jesus who lived in the way he did and to treat him as someone unworthy of a headstone or a grave, that way of life, according to them, amounts to nothingness. Follow at your own risk. Degradation was the point. Dehumanization was the point. When you walk through the crown of thorns and the spear in the side and all of that, and the public shaming, the nakedness by which somebody was portrayed on there, and then the fact that they would leave their bodies hanging there for the birds to eat and all of the things to be taking place. This is a very shameful way of doing it, meant to communicate a message, executed publicly, situated always at a major crossroads or on a well-trafficked artery, devoid of clothing, left to be eaten by birds and beasts. Victims of crucifixion were subject to optimal, unmitigated, vicious ridicule. An idea in the eyes of Rome was this: the quicker we can dehumanize somebody, the more we can write off their perspective on how the world works and their world view. And we do this today. We don't do this in this kind of tragic, murderous way, but the concept is still the same. Dehumanize them, therefore they're not even human. We can therefore disregard their take on how bad America is or how bad this is or whatever the case may be. But it's all about this idea of dehumanization. For Rome, the point of crucifixion was dehumanization, because for them that invalidated their claims or that person's claims to how the best way to do life was. So when we read this story, when we go through this, it would be important for us as we prepare for Easter, when we see this is not a normal sort of death. This was a strategic death to dehumanize a person and therefore invalidate his purpose for existence. Now, in response to dehumanization, in the 14th century, a group of Franciscan monks attempted to do the opposite regarding the death of Jesus. They wanted to humanize the story of who he was. In order to do that well, they attempted to recreate the walk from Pilate's Praetorium to the site that they believed to be Golgotha, or the place of the skull. To do something we call walk in the shoes of somebody. See where they walked. Smell the air that they might have smelled. Look at the landscape in the way that it was. My wife and I went to Virginia Beach a couple of years ago, 4 or 5 years ago now. And while we were there, we had a free day and we were on our way back to the airport in Norfolk. And we drove through and stopped at First Landing Beach. This is where settlers from England came over. This would have been the first thing that they saw as they made their way into the settlement of Jamestown, back into the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay. And we got to be there. And there's signs everywhere. And it's all very undeveloped intentionally to say, this is what it would have looked like. And this would be the sand. This would be the grass, the lack of trees, the questioning the water, but kind of all over the place. And it's not hard to sit there and to be kind of in a spot where you're like, man, aside from the skyscrapers, this is what it would have looked like for them when they got in a boat for months, many of them dying on the way here just to find freedom in a new land and see this. I mean, it does something to you, right? That's the point of it. That's why you've gone on like tours of the Roman Colosseum. You go in, you have a tour guide say, this is where they would have sat. This is where the gladiators would have come out. This is where the animals were kept. This is where the emperor sat. This is where all of these, and you, once you're there, you like, there's a new ownership in terms of that memory and the idea about the Roman Colosseum or the Camino or all kinds of different. We do pilgrimages to get in the shoes of this, to walk there, to be there, to see it, to feel it, to know what it's like viscerally, tacitly, with our hands, with our eyes, with our nose, with our ears, what it feels like. So in the 14th century, they said, we want to humanize the dehumanized version of Jesus. We want to walk in those footsteps. They created what's called the Via Dolorosa, or the sorrowful way, the way of suffering. It's a street right now in the old city of Jerusalem, and they've created sort of a system. They've systematized it, and they said there's basically 14 stations of the cross that you can walk to. If you go there today and say, I want to do the Via Dolorosa, Again, it's not a biblical thing. It does not show up in scripture about the Via Dolorosa. There's nothing in there about that. It's our way of understanding and making sense of why Jesus' death means something to us. And in order to get there, we go humanizing. So they create these 14 stations, and some of the stations are great. They're like, this is the Praetorium. This is what we know about that. This is what we think is Golgotha. We don't know for sure. It could have been this. It's the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, based on some people. It's this like Christian version over here. It's basically two straps for both. Who knows where it actually was, right? Along the way, this is where Cyrene picked up the cross. We don't know that for sure. This is just a place that they said, this might be where Cyrene picked up the cross. Could be, could not be. This is, and then there's one station. This is where Victoria handed Jesus a handkerchief to wipe his brow. And you're like, Victoria, who's Victoria? That's exciting. And they're like, we don't know. We made it up. We wanted to get a relic. We thought, this is true. This is honestly, we thought if we could get a relic of a handkerchief with Jesus' sweat on it, then we would take it to people and they could touch it and be like, I touched the sweat of Jesus and it healed my cancer, right? And all this kind of stuff. And so anyways, that's crazy. Kind of off, I don't believe in that. But that's what we've done to try and recreate this moment for these things. The Via Dolorosa. It's got a ring to it, doesn't it? For some of you, it has a ring to it because you remember it from a Sandy Patty song a long time ago. You know who you are. You're giggling right now. And my dad, I grew up in a Christian home. My dad was a pastor. And so when I said, he asked me last week, what are you starting? What series are you doing? I said, Via Dolorosa. And he's like, ooh, you're going to sing the song? I'm like, not planning on it. You want to come? You start and I'll join in the second verse. That's what I said. He's like, no, thanks. I'm good. This is what they believe. The creation of the Via Dolorosa was a way for the church to attempt to make sense of the crucifixion. I mentioned it's an evolution of thought. This was an evolution for them. Let's create a moment where we feel this. And that's good. That's what we should do, to feel and see what it would have been like. Here's what they came to realize and to codify. Jesus' death made all the difference in the world and all the difference to the world. Now, it's gonna get more complicated. There's gonna be different webs that you can kind of go and be like, how exactly that takes place. And I mentioned lots of different options and you can go searching for sure. But the main premise, then the big idea behind this, the big idea behind our talk today and what I wanna communicate and what I hope you leave in our time together is this, that Jesus' death made a difference in the world and all the difference to the world. That's what we do know. Attempts to define this has occupied authors and artists for hundreds of years. N.T. Wright, one of my favorites, said this, the story of Jesus' crucifixion is the story par excellence, the best kind of a story, the one that encapsulates it the most, in which all human beings are confronted with the full darkness of human life and with the possibility through inhabiting that story themselves of finding a way through. Which is why we use this imagery and we say, I've just got to bear my cross. It's the cross I've got to bear. It's the thing I've got to get through in the midst of darkness and the things pressing upon me. I just push this, put this on my shoulder and I'm plowing through. I don't know what the future holds. I don't know if I'm going to get good news from the doctor. I don't know if this marriage is going to work out. I don't know if we'll ever see the other side of this thing financially, but I'm pushing my way through. We see that story. There's something that resonates deeply in this. Even as we read it, maybe we're not particularly religious, but this part of it, watching somebody suffer at the hands of power, someone who was about others, who seemed to give his life for others, and then to have that be stepped on and pushed in and made fun of and mocked. There's something about that that resonates deeply within us, even if we don't understand how to connect the dots to what that means for me personally. The point of N.T. Wright is there's something about that story, that we find ourselves in that story, that it made a difference to the world, that it makes all the difference in the world. You don't have to understand the complexity of exactly how in order to experience the effect of it. And the reason I know this is true is because I'm not super into music theory and I don't exactly know how acoustics in a room work, but I can still be moved by music. Not that great of a cook, but I still know what a good meal is. I know the difference between McDonald's and something fancy, like a Michelin star restaurant. I don't know all the entailing things in that, but I can still feel the effects of it. And the point that the church has been making for centuries now, over and over and over again, is that the death of Christ means something to us. We're still working out the hows. We're trying to embody it a little bit. We're trying to humanize it. It was an intensely degrading moment, dehumanizing thing. Let's rehumanize it. Let's create this Via Dolorosa in order to better perhaps understand this. We are only the latest in a long line of people who have wrestled with the meaning of the cross down through the years. And I mentioned books, I mentioned stained glass windows, I mentioned art, a lot of paintings about this sort of thing. But also song. There's a famous hymn written by Isaac Watts called When I Survey the Wondrous Cross. And it starts off like this. When I survey the wondrous, I'm not gonna sing that either because that's even worse than Via Dolorosa. On which the Prince of Glory died, my richest gain I count but loss and pour contempt on all my pride. Were the whole realm of nature mine, that were an offering far too small. If I had everything, if I could give everything to this, it would be an offering. And if I could give that, it wouldn't equate to the depth of the grace that I have in experiencing this side of the cross. Love so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my all. That without going into detail of what it exactly means, he can still respond and go, I don't know everything, but here's what I do know. That meant something to me, and the demand on me that I have imposed upon myself is my soul, my life, my all. Deep, deep resonate. This week, I was up in north of Spokane. We are part of a cohort with Whitworth University, 6 or 7 churches kind of scattered throughout the nation, really, and trying to look at our communities, what makes us unique in our community, how do we be resilient in light of the secularization of culture and everything else. And so lots of ideas, thoughts, theories. They bring in social science professors to kind of talk through demographics in our area. What can we do strategy-wise? Anyways, it was great. It's awesome. It's been a 3-year process. We're just starting year 2 of that. And so they pull us all up to this Camp Spalding, north of Spokane, in a place that's beautiful, but kind of in the mountains, and therefore the reception is questionable, right? 1-2 bars, depending on kind of where you stand. If you stand on 1 foot, you can kind of get more, that kind of thing. Wi-Fi in and out, all the things, right? It reminds you we're really roughing it here, you know what I mean? So roughing it in heated, nice rooms with great food. Anyways, not roughing it at all, but whatever. As I'm up there, we're in a session. I feel my phone buzz in my pocket. I pull it out and I do that thing where it sends it to voicemail. And now, do you know what it does? It transcribes people, like their voicemails. It's amazing. You need to update your phone. It's so great. I'm watching them leave me a voicemail and the text is coming through on the screen. And it says, hi, my name is so-and-so. I'm with Tri-Cities Chaplaincy Center and I'm over at Cadillac, which I know is Cadillac. Siri sucks. So it's Cadillac, it's always that. I'm over at Cadillac and I've got someone here that has requested your presence, right? We've got somebody, one of your parishioners is here. And then all of a sudden my mind's racing, right? And they don't leave any information because of privacy stuff. They don't leave who it was or whatever. So all of a sudden my mind's racing, who this is and whatever. So at our next break, I sneak away and find a spot, stand on 1 foot and make a phone call. It's a little choppy coming through. And she goes, I'm here with Al Casper. And I'm like, Al? Yeah, Al and Mary. Mary's here too. And she sent this. And I'm like, Mary, I don't know an Al. And I do the thing where, you do this too. Like if you read about somebody in the paper who died, you immediately, that name kind of sounds familiar. You kind of go through your phone or go on your Facebook page to see if you guys are friends. So we have an internal sort of planning center people thing that kind of tracks a database that has all that information. So I look up Al Casper, Al C, and I'm coming up with nothing. I'm like, I don't know. I don't think we have one of those. And I tell her that. I'm on speakerphone. I'm like, I don't know Al Casper. I don't have an Al Casper in here. And she says, well, she said that they come every once in a while. And and I said, well, give them my phone number. I'm happy to reach out to them. We have people all the time who come once a month or, Christmas and Easter, and this is my church. And you're like, really? That's amazing. Thank you for thinking of us as your church. And so I said, yeah, give them my info. And when I get back into town, I'd love to meet up with them and do whatever. And then I remember going back to the session and I'm sitting in a chair and it dawns on me who it is. And I know exactly who it is. She got the names wrong a little bit. But his name's Al Casabir. And I used to call him Casaberry because I'd see his card come through. And I remember him one time correcting me. He was so kind. I probably said, Alan Casaberry. And he would just nod and do whatever. And And then one day he's like, it's actually a case of beer. And I go, oh, all right, I'll try to remember. And he goes, it's a case of beer. You should probably remember that. That's pretty easy. You know what I mean? And I've never forgot about it ever since. And so, case of beer. He and his wife, Barbara, I think her legal name was Mary. That's why, whatever. Anyways, she got the name wrong or she got the name wrong. Either way, would come in. They would come to second service. And they would sit in the blue chairs until the music was over. It's a little too loud for them. That's fine. It's great. And I would always, I'd see him. He'd be sitting there. He would drop her off because she walks with a cane. And then he would go park the car and he would walk in a little bit later. He would always come up and be so kind. And I'd go to reach for a handshake and he'd always go knuckles. And I forget every time. I'd be like, hey, Al, good to see you. And he'd be like, hey, man. And I'm like, oh, that's right. Dang it. Forgot. Sorry. And then he would always ask about our series, like, what are we doing? What are we talking on this week? And I'm always like, well, we're going to talk about it in just a few minutes, but I'll tell you out here if you want, right? So, but he knew he was always up to date on where we are. So this is part four of Grace or whatever. And I don't know if he was doing that to appease me because sometimes I forget kind of what week we're on some things or what series we're in. So he was always great at that. I think he loved that. And he always had super kind words. Oh, I loved what you said last week. Loved what you said last week. So anyways, that was a fun thing. Al and Barb were here last weekend. Last Sunday, they sat out in those blue chairs. And on Tuesday night, he suffered a stroke and he passed on Wednesday at a hospice center in Kennewick. And I met with Barbara in their home on Friday and she told me how much she loved and missed him already. And she's probably watching this online. And she mentioned that he found Eastlake back when we were at Southridge and then when they got married 7 years ago, she came as part of the package deal. And she said that he was never particularly religious prior to Eastlake. I mean, he connected with God mostly through nature and outside, sitting on their patio in North Richland watching the sunset. He spent some time working in Alaska. That probably helped a little bit with some of that with Weyerhaeuser. But he took communion at Eastlake this is what she told me. As I'm sitting there on a couch on Friday, she said he took communion at Eastlake for the very first time last week. Maybe not ever, she said, because she didn't know, beforehand, but first time at Eastlake since she's been coming with him. He leaned over at the end of a Grace series and he said, I think I'm ready to take communion. And here's how, and I know that that sounds like a pastor story, right? Like, oh, sure. It also sounds like if you've never taken communion, I'll never be taking communion at your church next week. But here's how I know it's not a pastor story because he leaned over to her and he's like, do you want me to go up and grab you one? Because we have you guys come up and grab some and take some back. And she says, no, I can never get the damn things open. So don't grab me one. So I said, fair enough, Barbara. I believe that. But there was something, and he looked at her and he said, I think I'm going to go receive communion. And she said, she said something about grace, and I think there's enough grace for you in that. And I don't know why last week was the week. I mean, we don't even take communion every week. We only do it once a month or so. And I don't know why in that moment, if there was something that was said or something that was felt or something in the song that he sang or the words, we do the explanation of what we believe about communion on there enough. But something inside of him moved him to realize that Jesus' death means something to the world and it means something to me. So he participated in the sacrament of Holy Communion with us. Now, did Al know how Jesus' crucifixion accomplishes substitutionary atonement? I mean, come on, doubtful. He never asked me about it, never had the chance to kind of walk him through it. We have the screens that kind of explain it, but I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think he knew the details. I think he was moved. I think that there was something in there that was like, I want this for me. Listen, you don't have to have a theory about why the cross is so powerful before you can be moved and changed and before you can know yourself to be loved and forgiven. You don't have to have all of those things in order. Jesus' death made all the difference in the world and all the difference to the world. And to you, and to me, and to Al, and to us. So, for the next couple of weeks, I want to continue to explore what the death of Christ might mean. N.T. Wright would say, that's the day the revolution began. that on Easter Sunday, we celebrate the first sign of the new revolution, of something that stands out, that the resurrection was the first point that something is now different. And in order to truly and freely appreciate the greatness that is Easter morning, sometimes you have to suffer through some of the other things beforehand. You have to know what darkness feels like. That's why the church for centuries have done Good Friday services, that Easter's not just all about a party, that there's a reason to have a party because of the depth in which you have to go to get there. It's always darkest before the dawn. What does this mean for us? What does this mean for you? That's what I want to explore together, and we'll do more on that next week. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for the cross. We thank you for the writers who thought this important enough to write down for us, the story that comes through this, the way that we see ourselves in this, the efforts of the church over the years to humanize this, to work through and process through what this means for us. We find ourselves in that journey as well, discovering what it would mean for us. That you would show up and incarnate, that you would become fully God, fully man, experience this sort of thing, to be one of us and to be put to death, to have the world see someone who lived a certain way and do their best to dehumanize it to the point of meaninglessness, pointlessness, follow at your own risk. And for that to be the inspiration for us to say, maybe that is something worth following. Maybe there is hope there. Maybe there's a message there. Maybe we too can come to a spot where we believe that the cross means something to the world and makes all the difference in the world. And may we follow in the footsteps of the disciples who are trying to make sense of what this looks like and means for me. Give us the wisdom to know what that looks like in our life and the courage to do something about it in your name. Amen.
Thanks again for listening. If you've got more questions about the church or community group options for connecting with East Lakers outside of Sunday mornings, I'd encourage you to check out our website, eastlaketricities.com, or better yet, download our app by searching East Lake Tri-Cities in your favorite app store.